Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is sponsored by ChampionshipBreeders.com. Championship Breeders is a proud supporter of the American Kennel Club, our specialty and all breed clubs, our dog sports, and the gifts of therapy and service from our canine companions.
Dr. Gail Watkins, welcome back to Pure Dog Talk.
Thanks, Mary.
And today I believe that you're going to give us a full education on the neonatal period of our puppies.
Well, I don't know if it'll be a full education, but we'll get started in talking about this really important period.
More than I knew when you did your seminar, which was so fantastic. If you ever have a chance to go to an Avidog seminar, it's a must.
Thank you. Thank you. So the neonatal period, we call this period where they go from potatoes to puppies because neonatal puppies are just so helpless. They're such an unusual phase of dogs. And if you've raised puppies, you don't think anything about it, but they don't really look like dogs or act like dogs. They appear to be completely helpless. They can't see, hear, can't control their body temperature. They can only move in circles. They have very limited ability to communicate. They can't even pee and poop on their own. So they're a really apparently helpless creature. But in reality, there's an awful lot going on in their brains. This is a massive stage of brain development in puppies. They are creating synapses, connections between brain cells. They are also cutting them out. They're reducing the number of synapses they have that aren't of value to them. So even this early in a puppy's life, its brain's making a decision about what nerve connections it needs and which ones it doesn't. So as we think about the kinds of activities those puppies should be involved in, kind of environment that they need, a lot of it is related to setting their brain up for lifetime success, as well as their immune system and their body. So what are the things that I think about that really leap out during this period? Number one, mothers. Their mother is so key to their development. It's really incalculable. So mother dogs, in addition to providing heat or warmth and milk, also do mothering. And mothering is a term that captures the kinds of things that moms do to puppies. So they lick them, they clean them, they poke them, they scrub them down, they touch them. They touch them all over. A lot of the touching is on the genitals as they clean the puppies, but they're rolling them around. Some moms might even put their paw on them to scrub them and make sure that they're spotless. All of those actions are developing the puppy far beyond just hygiene, just cleanliness. It stabilizes the puppy's stress management response over a lifetime. So it is that mothering that sets our dogs up to be able to handle stress in the future. And so what are stress management systems in dogs? How do we see it? Well, we know we talk about bomb-proof dogs, dogs that just don't respond to stressful events. Or if they do, they could be startled by something, but then they just shake it off and they go on and they don't get upset. They don't get aggressive. They don't react to it. They don't bark at it. That's a very good stress management system. It's a stress management system that realizes there's stress. It goes up and then it immediately comes back down again. There are other dogs with less effective stress management systems, and those are dogs that go up, that spin up, and don't come back down again. And their body has trouble re-engaging or stabilizing their response to the world. So depending upon the breed or even the individual dog, that could be reactivity. So it could be reactive barking. It could be aggression, depending upon the breed. Or it could be fearfulness, bolting, running, quivering, shaking, urinating, things like that. And those are at the extremes. There are the dogs that maybe aren't that bad, but simply once they get stressed, they have trouble getting themselves back under control again. So what differentiates a dog's ability to respond to stress as an adult? Well, some of it is going to be its genetics, what it got from its parents, but a lot of it is the mothering that it received in the first 2 weeks of life. And so allowing moms access to their puppies, ensuring that we select moms that do engage with their puppies in those first 2 weeks, and then stepping back and letting it happen. We monitor it, but you've raised puppies. You know it's not real gentle sometimes. I mean, they can be really scrubbing puppies down and the puppy's crying and mom couldn't care less. She's going to do what she needs to do to make sure that that puppy is okay. So we're going to focus on mothering first and foremost, and we're going to try to make sure that we allow our moms to mother. Now, there are moms that just have no intention of mothering. They are either disinterested or they're even aggressive towards their puppies. We want to then make sure that our puppies are protected from those mothers. An option for some readers who have more than one dog is if you have an auntie, less often an uncle. Uncles like to go play with puppies, but they don't necessarily like to mother them, but although some will. But there are aunties or grandmas that want to be in with the puppies and engage with them. And if you have an aggressive dam, you can look for that option as well. Carefully, but you can use that. The other thing that we need to do is set an environment up that encourages mom to mother. And the number one aspect of that is room temperature or ambient temperature. If you read any breeding book, it will tell you to keep your whelping room at 80 degrees or even 90 degrees. And for your average, medium, large, or giant breed dog, that is the equivalent of hell on earth. It is so hot, and they have these puppies up against them, and they're lactating, which already raises their body temperature. We just cook our dams if we put them at that temperature. If instead we drop the ambient temperature to that temperature that pushes mom and puppies together so that the puppies automatically are up against their mom to stay warm and the dam is comfortable having them there. So she curls around them or lies with them and through that process has the contact that we would need for good mothering. In addition, simply touching her puppies will improve her lactation. It will improve her milk production. Her milk will be let down even more quickly. So if we think about ambient temperature, not as we have to keep the puppy's body temperature at 100 degrees because they can't control it, and instead understand that that's what moms are for and that moms are able to keep their puppies warm typically. And so we're going to use the room temperature to push mom and puppies together.
Well, that's a good one because I've always followed the thing where you put the heating pad and the puppies go lay on the heating pad and mom goes lay where some it's a little bit cooler. And so obviously something else I've been doing wrong.
Well, I think we all did it. You know, we were taught early on either a heating lamp or a heating pad in the box all the time. And so we ended up with puppies on one side and moms on the other. If you have a Newfoundland, she's not lying underneath a heating lamp. It's just too hot for her. Now, if you have toy breeds, you need to keep your room temperature warmer because they are smaller. They don't have as much mass. But if you have a toted breed or you have a large or giant breed, you can bring the temperature down. So, for example, our whelping rooms are typically between 70 and 72 degrees. How do we know the temperature is right? Puppies are up against mom and puppies are quiet. I had this funny phone call once where a friend called and said, I have such a high drive litter. These are going to be great performance dogs. And I was thinking, they're 2 days old. How could you possibly know that? And she said, because they're crying all the time. They just have so much go. And I said, no, they're just too hot. Lower the temperature. Sure enough, she lowered the room temperature and the puppies got delightfully quiet. And that's when you know, when you have that puppies nursing away, but no crying or whining or that constant screaming. If you hear that kind of noise, something's not right. And often it's room temperature.
So something else you discussed in the seminar during the neonatal period had to do with the touch, taste, and smell development at this time.
Absolutely. This is the time that we can really push the three senses that are working in puppies at this stage. So that's going to be their ability to smell, taste, and touch. Many, many, many people have done early neurologic stimulation, or also known as biosensor, that was introduced by Dr. Carmen Battaglia back in 1995, I think, and published it in the AKC Gazette, a magazine I miss terribly. And that started people off in doing early neurologic stimulation. I'll make sure that you have on the resource page the pictures for each of the positions for early neurologic stimulation for your listeners. But it's a series of four positions and then two touches to very mildly stimulate puppy's sense of proprioception, where they are in space, which is part of touch, as well as temperature. And then we tickle a foot once a day. We only do those for 3 to 5 seconds, so it's very quick. We aren't trying to overwhelm the puppy with these mild stressors, but in doing this stressing, it is a formalized method of handling that makes us put puppies out of their comfort zone and often out of our comfort zone, because we don't particularly like pointing puppies' head down or putting them on their back because they tend to cry. But if we know we're only doing it for 3 to 5 seconds and that it benefits the puppy over a lifetime, then it's worth doing. You can do a litter of 12 puppies in 10 minutes doing biosensor. It's a very, very quick process. And it will benefit them, particularly that stress management system that we were talking about, for a lifetime. The other thing that we do is we stimulate their scenting ability, because many of the dogs that we produce go on to some sort of working home. And we can do this even for pets, because most pet owners love to watch their dog use their nose. So about 13 years ago now, we started early scent introduction, and we just coupled it with early neurologic stimulation. We did them at the same time. And so from day 3 to day 16, early in the neonatal and a little into transition period, we introduce a unique scent to the puppies once a day. So one scent once a day for 13 days. You have to think of 13 things for them to sniff. Those things can be any natural item. It can be a training item. If you have herding dogs, you might want to do wool, do some sheep wool or duck feathers. If you have hunting dogs, you might want to do some sort of game bird wing. But you're going to let them smell different items for 3 to 5 seconds. So it's a very short period. We'll often use fruit. We'll use lemons or apples. We'll use herbs and spices, cinnamon and basil. If we can smell it, if it's really pungent and we can smell it, then it's a good thing to offer the puppies. I have a lot of obedience breeders who follow this, and my recommendation if you produce dogs for obedience is don't do metal. You know, we do metal scent articles in utility, but that isn't something that puppies can really smell. But you can do wood, grass, leaves, leather, all kinds of things like that. What shouldn't you use? You shouldn't use foods, things that dogs consider foods, such as meat or cheeses. You can use bananas because although dogs like bananas, puppies don't think of them as food. And you're just going to hold the puppy gently upright, you know, so their tail down and head up, and you're going to put the scent object right in front of them, you know, maybe half an inch from their nose, and you're going to let them react however they react. So about half the time, you'll typically get a neutral reaction, which is the puppy just sits there. You can see their nose is moving and that they're sniffing, but they don't have a strong reaction one way or the other. For maybe 25% of objects, the puppy expresses extreme dislike. I find this happens a lot with bananas for some reason. Even though my adult dogs love bananas, not many puppies do. And so how do you know that they don't like it? They whip their head away and they will often vocalize it. You'll also hear them trying to clear their nose. So they'll snort out of their nose to try and clear the scent out of it. And then maybe 25% of the objects the puppies will love. They will get so engaged, they'll try and paddle closer to it. They'll move their face towards it. They might even bury their face in it. And in some cases, interestingly enough, they'll try and taste it, because taste and scent are really closely connected. And so you'll see them put their mouth on it and maybe lick it as well. I have trouble predicting what is going to elicit that kind of response from puppies, but a lot of times if it's a working breed, it will be something related to the work. So it might be wool for a kuvaz, or it might be a duck wing for a Labrador retriever, and it might be a quail for a pointing breed. So it really tends to depend upon what they've been bred for. You might get this really strong positive reaction. When you get those positive reactions, it's perfectly fine to go for more than 5 seconds and just let them enjoy it. You're going to do this once a day, so it adds about 3 to 5 seconds to your day, aside from figuring out what you're going to let them smell. And what we've found, we did a study looking at two different cohorts of dogs, one that had this done with it and one that did not. And these dogs were able to succeed at scenting better. So they were achieving higher levels of scenting ability. So we studied this over about a 12-year period, two cohorts, one that had early scent introduction, the other that did not. The dogs that had early scent introduction were able to achieve scenting accomplishments much sooner at a much higher level and much more complex accomplishments. And so we've kept doing it because, one, our dogs love it, as do our owners. But two, it's really fabulous to see that just doing these short little exercises from days 3 to 16 can have such a lifetime effect on dogs.
Speaking of lifetime effects on dogs, last week in episode 11, you discussed the importance of probiotics for both adults and puppies and recommended the probiotic Geniflora. Our sponsor, Neil, at geniflorafortpets.com, has offered our listeners a 15% discount on Geniflora. Just use the code PUREDOG at checkout at geniflorafortpets.com. So, Gail, the last piece I would love for you to address is the latest research in regards to hip dysplasia and traction in the whelping box.
Yeah, so traction is really this very interesting aspect of raising puppies because we're trying to balance hygiene and cleanliness with the health of the puppies. And for many of us who have been breeding for a long time, we started raising our puppies on newspaper. That was what was available to us, and that's what we used, never really realizing that newspaper is very slippery for puppies. And if you've never seen puppies raised any other way, then it looks normal when they slip and slide, and you're always looking at the bottom of their pads on their back feet. So they're flipped with their feet facing skyward because they can't get their feet under them. And that's what we thought was normal in puppies. Fast forward to today, and now we know that traction can have a significant effect on reducing orthopedic issues in dogs. And with good traction, puppies can be up on their feet, standing up within hours of birth. They're not coordinated enough to walk yet, but they can hobble around and they can stand up so that they get higher on the bitch for nursing. And so we are always looking for a couple of things to tell us whether traction is good in a whelping box. Are we seeing puppies' legs slip out from underneath them? We should not be seeing that at all. Are we looking at the back pads, the pads on the bottom of the feet? If we're seeing those all the time, then the puppy is not able to get its hind legs underneath them. And then thirdly, are the puppies staying low on the dam, or are they able to get at least halfway up her rib cage, if not higher? So now we have x-rays that show that joints in puppies are not connected. Truly, the hip bone is not connected to the leg bone. There are these very large gaps between the bones in the joints that close over time, and they are developed. The joints themselves are formed through the pressure that comes from the use of the joint. So a puppy that is standing from very early on is much more likely to not develop hip dysplasia than one whose hips are constantly slipping out from underneath him. There have been a number of guide organizations that have changed their traction. We changed our traction, and the reduction in hip dysplasia is significant to the point that you can be at 0% hip dysplasia, obviously by selecting healthy parents, but also by focusing on traction. Carol Bouchat at the Institute for Canine Biology has also put out a lot of information on traction and showed a lot of videos comparing different surfaces and the effect that they have on traction. So we'll link to that as well so that people can take a look at those videos and see the difference. We use a product called Sterilon, S-T-E-R-I-L-O-N. It's not particularly easy to get. It's only carried in the United States by a single company, and there's another company in Canada that carries it. I'll give you the links for that so that you can share that with your listeners. But there are other fleece products, and fleece is usually your best bet, that are equally effective. Things like newspaper, plastic, linoleum, tile, those are not going to be successful in developing good joints in our puppies.
Thank you, Dr. Gail Watkins.
Thanks, Mary.
Three things before we go. First, next week, Gail will be back for part 3, the transition period of puppy development. Second, as you can hear, Gail is a wealth of knowledge. And if you are serious about breeding, learning, or raising better puppies, Avidog.com is offering 25% off their course, Introduction to Transformational Dog Breeding. Just use the code PUREDOGTALK. Third, as always, show notes and links to all the resources, Photos of ENS, links to a video on early scent introduction are all available on our website, puredogtalk.com. Thanks for listening, and we will talk next week. Take care.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.